This season of My First Dungeon is sponsored by Tabletop Bookshelf. Tabletop Bookshelf is one of the best places to buy indie TTRPGs online and has been one of my personal favorite purveyors of indie games for a while now. And we are thrilled to be partnering with them to produce this season of Perils and Princesses. If you want to grab your own copy of Perils and Princesses or the adventure module that we are going to be playing called Sweet Revenge, then head on over to tabletopbookshelf.com and use the promo code PERIL15, that's PERIL15, for 15% off your game purchase. This is the largest discount that Tabletop Bookshelf has ever offered on one of the best-selling games in their store. And they're only offering this discount to the first 100 customers who use it. So don't delay. Go to tabletopbookshelf.com and grab your own copy of this gritty and pretty masterpiece. And with that, enjoy the show. Once upon a time, there was a princess. Well, actually, a few princesses. You've probably heard of their stories. The princesses who were locked away in towers or who had evil step-parents, the ones who kissed frogs or tamed beasts or were secretly mermaids. You know, those princesses. But what happens to those princesses when they find themselves in a whole new world with new perils lurking around every corner? A world of dragons and monsters and wizards and the dark, scary things that hide in the dark, scary places. Luckily, they begin their adventure specially equipped to deal with the challenges that await. They have their resolve, their grace, and their wits, the kind of inner strength that only princesses possess. Paired with a basket of goodies and a special gift from their fairy godmothers, they sharpen their swords, light their torches, polish their glass slippers, and set out together to delve into the darkest dungeons.
Hello and welcome to another season of My First Dungeon, the tabletop role-playing podcast that helps GMs learn new games and make each one better than the last. This season, we are getting gritty and pretty in our first foray into the OSR, or the old school renaissance, with Perils and Princesses. I, Elliot Davis, will be your host for today, and in fact, the producer for this season, and with me is your GM for the season. You know him, you love him. Brian Flaherty, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I am very excited to get started on this one.
Me too. Cannot wait. As you know, we always want to set our GMs up for success, and you are our GM, so let's set you up for success. And in fact, what better resource than the creator of Perils and Princesses, Ryan Lynch? Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being
so
here.
So good to have you. So, to get us started, Ryan, could you tell us what is Perils and Princesses and what kind of stories is this game trying to tell?
Yeah, so Perils and Princesses is a fairy tale adventure role-playing game where you play as a princess, gender neutral, a princess who has a gift from a fairy godmother that they use to go on these adventures. It's based on a certain type of fantasy, you know, stemming back from Grimm's fairy tales or into, you know, the common kind of Disney princess movie. Also heavily influenced by like a sort of fantasy that's different than the sword and sorcery Dungeons and Dragons fantasy. There's like a separate thread there of this more humble fantasy that relates to fairy tales, fantasy. You know, it's more The Hobbit and less Lord of the Rings. It's a little bit more humble. It's a little bit about using your cleverness and these little things. Some of the influences are like the old George MacDonald Princess and the Goblin stories that inspired Lord of the Rings, like taking that through Grimm's fairy tales, through those Disney princess movies, and even like, you know, some of those YA adventure novels from like the 70s and 80s and 90s, like the Enchanted Forest Chronicles or even Chronicles of Prydain or Narnia, where you've got these more humble characters going on these fairy tale adventures.
And Brian, on your end, you know, what kind of drew you to wanting to play this game on the show? What stuck it with you?
So Ryan reached out a few months ago and was like, hey, I'd love to send you a copy of Perils and Princesses. because I was doing a lot of like TikTok videos talking about games. And I was like, yeah, sure, this looks cool. I'm excited to check it out. The art like really caught me first off. And then I opened this book and we've been wanting to do an OSR game on the show for a while. Like Morkborg, you know, Mothership is kind of in that realm, Into the Odd, stuff like that. And I opened this up and I was just like, oh, yes. Yes. Num, 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 num. Yes. So A, like the art style and the layout of this book is just gorgeous. The rules are great, made me really excited. The like gift dice system, which we're going to get into, was like a really cool mechanic for like spell casting and abilities that I really loved. And then adding on to that, like the fairy tale element that is so great, because as you were saying, like fairy tales can go from like grim, dark Grimm's fairy tales all the way to like Disney princesses and anywhere in between. And because you have that big spectrum to play in, you can really play with expectations and tone, even within the same story, because it can kind of go to either end of the spectrum, which is really fun. And then I also read, I was already like, yes, I want to play this game very soon. And then I read the adventure module that we're going to run, Sweet Revenge. And I was like, oh, we're going to play this now.
Hell yeah. So I guess before we get too much further, there's a term in here we're talking about, which is OSR, Old School Renaissance. And for the listener who doesn't know, there's a million ways that people could define this school of game design. One of the ways is these four principles: ruling over rules, player skill over character ability, heroic over superheroic, and game balance not being important. Ryan, I'm curious on your end, because you mentioned this, that this game is OSR, but it breaks away. How does Perils and Princesses fall within the school of OSR, and how does it sort of break away from it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question, because I think those four tenets you listed are very much a part of Perils and Princesses, right? So I think at its core, not only in its philosophy of that kind of rules light, but encouraging player creativity, Perils and Princesses very much is that. It's very much a creative problem solving game, and a game that doesn't try to explain everything and sort of trust the GM and trust the players to take broad concepts and apply them to specific instances. So like, foundationally, it very much is that. Now, I think a lot of OSR games use this nitty grittiness to arrive at a different destination, right? You've got your motherships and your Merkborgs and your games where that kind of grittiness is there to evoke desperation, right? Like, mm-hmm. spit in the face of death. You know, it's a very different tone. Whereas Perils and Princesses, that kind of heroic versus superheroic is there rather than desperation, is more inspiration, right? The power fantasy is that the little bit of magic you have inside, and by working together, you can save the day, right? So it uses those OSR tools, but then brings them in a little bit different direction, which I think is fun and sets it apart.
I've been really interested in OSR games, but there is a thing of what you're saying of like a lot of them want to get to this like grimdark desperation place, which is just a world that I don't naturally fall into. Whereas like, I'm a child of the 90s. I was raised on Disney princesses. Are you kidding me? And so like having this game still have all of the danger and like heroics of OSR games, but not having to go only to that grim dark place where you have to live in this like, you know, Merkborg, you know, very desolate world. I like living in a much brighter world that you can put darkness into. That dynamism is way more interesting and exciting to me overall.
Yeah. And you know, and even coming at it from the other angle, right? Like you'll see princess games or fairy tale games rely on tropes, or they're more narrative games, right? And OSR isn't really a narrative space as much as it is sort of like a more literal kind of physics-based game engine. But, you know, what I found is playing with kids and playing with families, if you're not familiar with all those story beats or narrative beats or tropes, it becomes a little bit harder to access. Whereas by giving the tools, like the abilities and the different mechanics, which we can go into, that lets the players, like, that lets those narrative beats happen organically is kind of a different thing. And I think it helps get young players in and families in that might not be able to just draw on a trope and plop it in, or draw on a narrative moment or a story structure moment and use that as their drive for it, you know?
So Brian, I want to dig in. You mentioned a little bit in there about like what you're concerned about when it comes to like first OSR, a little bit uneasy. Are there other things you're nervous about approaching the season as a GM that we can lay out and have Ryan help you out with today?
So yeah, I've never run or really even played in any OSR style games. Like, I've played D&D, which is like where OSR stuff has its roots, but I played, you know, 5th edition, which is a very different from what a lot of this is. I know a lot of the tenets, but I also know that some of the things are like, this is a world that is not meant to be balanced, which my thing is like, how do I properly communicate that tone and experience to the players so that they know? Because I know some of the players are more familiar with something like D&D, where it is a super heroic fantasy rather than just a heroic fantasy, who may not know that running away is probably the best option sometimes. Whereas I know one of the players for this season plays a lot of Cthulhu and will definitely know to run away at certain times. And then I think the like grittiness and deadliness of danger of the system, I really want to make sure I like communicate to my players and also like communicate into the story and make it feel gritty and tough. And there's also some elements of like, I think this is the kind of game that gets more exciting when you kind of get into some of the nitty-gritty of like, you can only carry 5 things. What are you going to do with those? Like, there's interesting problems that happen because you're dealing with like things that in D&D or something you don't care about, like encumbrance you don't play with as much because it's a super heroic fantasy. But in this, if you can only carry a spear, a shield, and one other thing, and there's 2 things you got to carry, that is now a very interesting problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to make sure that I explore that while still making that exciting and fun, because there's a world where counting the number of meals you have or counting the inventory in your pack is not fun, but I know that it can be fun. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that it is.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think it gets at the heart of why this is an OSR game. And okay, like, first of all, speaking about inventory encumbrance, because that's what you were on, I think one of the reasons why you would do that in this game is because it makes little things heroic. So
yeah.
All of a sudden, if you're running out of food, finding berries is a heroic, cool thing. So I think the GM can do a lot with those little things and make it, you know, highlight those little moments, make them feel magical, make them feel exciting, make those, you know, and those hard choices just make the humble adventure that much more exciting and make those little tactile moments part of the story you're telling, right?
Yeah.
And then in terms of things like risk and danger, I always say don't get in the way of your players playing the game and making the choices. So I think a lot of OSR and Perils and Princesses is going to be about making sure your players know what's at stake, making sure that they know that this big thing is deadly and dangerous, and not being coy about like, well, you know, maybe you're not sure if this thing is scary or not. Like, right. Let them know, like, hey,
this is scary.
This big thing could crush you and you know it, right? Like, how they deal with that is going to be more interesting always than playing this kind of game where you're not giving the information. So I think being upfront with the stakes and being upfront with the information as the GM relaying the world to the players, like giving them the world and letting them make decisions based on what you're being upfront with is going to go a long way.
Yeah. Are you, Abby, afraid of a bear? That same fear should exist right here. That is how scary right. The bear is.
Yeah. And I think, you know, once you get into combat and damage rolls and things like that, this is a very swingy game. You don't know, you're not going to know how things are going to go.
Yeah.
And as a GM, you should be excited for them to go either way. Right. Mm-hmm. It's forgiving enough. Like, getting injured and losing all your hit points doesn't mean you're dead and out. Right. It means something interesting happens. It means you're wounded and your players can still, you know, get you out of that. Like, there's no, the stopping point isn't so harsh that if you get knocked out or something bad happens, you're still playing the game.
A lot of things I've read about OSR games is that it is, and I think this is true for any role-playing game, that you kind of want to tell your players it is really exciting. You're like, you should be trying not to roll the dice. You should be trying to make such good plans that the GM just wants to say yes. And then you, like, anytime you choose to roll the dice, now it's out of my hands. Like, I can't help you anymore. You've chosen to roll initiative. The dice will fall as they may, and that may or may not work out for you. Whereas if you go into it with, like, creative problem solving that the OSR really wants to highlight and amplify, then there's, you know, there's an interesting way to talk your way out of this. There's an interesting roundabout, you know, look at your character sheet. What weird little items can you maybe use to get around this encounter rather than having to face it head on? Because once you do, as you said, it is very swingy. It could, even if you're prepared and you feel like you, you know, you're level 3 princesses and this is a small encounter, the dice are the dice. And sometimes they want to tell a story that you do not want to tell.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing, is to only roll when there is a risk, right? We're only rolling when it's up in the air. We're not rolling just because, like, you're going to, again, be forward with information. We're going to fail forward too. And there's a mechanic called spend time.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've looked at that a lot. And it's basically a built-in random encounter check. And we call those wrinkles in Perils and Princesses, where, you know, you might get to a situation where something isn't inherently risky. Like, you could succeed in this given enough time, but now we're going to spend time and see what other stuff is going to happen depending on where you are, right? You roll a die, either a d4, d6, or d8, and if it's a 1, something unexpected happens, right? This happens if you're resting somewhere. A lot of mechanics say, like, you know, you can spend time to do this, and time is just this kind of, like, nebulous idea of something that takes time, right? Like, in a dungeon, it might be 10 minutes, but, like, it might be a day of foraging or whatever, or it might be a day of travel where, if it's risky, you roll a d4 if you're, like, in an enemy stronghold, but if it's just, like, a forest somewhere, it might be a d6 or d8, and then if a 1 shows up, something happens. So that is, like, a built-in way to let you keep moving the story forward. Like, this isn't, there's not a risk of failure. There's just a risk of something else happening while you're doing this, right?
I've been way more interested in random table, like, it kind of as my tabletop role-playing career or, like, journey has gone on. When I first started, I was like, I can't use published adventures. I have to make all my own stuff. Random tables are dumb. You gotta create, you know, whatever. And I've since found much more joy from, like, rolling on random tables to create characters or create encounters, because it gives you a jumping off point and then you fill in the rest with your imagination. But I'm excited, especially with, like, the spending time and this wrinkle ability. It feels like its own, like, random encounters like this feel like its own mini game within the game of, like, you tell your players, okay, they want to, you know, forage for stuff. Okay, great. You're going to be spending time. You know that this is a dangerous place. I'm going to be rolling 1d4. There might be a wrinkle. Are you sure? And now the players are kind of gambling within, like, in a minor moment.
Yep.
And just, you know, for the listener who's interested in, like, what some of these wrinkles would be in the core book, these are, like, some examples of travel wrinkles. If you roll a 1, aw, a bear cub, where's its mother? Mm-hmm. If you roll a 3, a rock slide has blocked the path. If you roll a 6, quicksand. Like, so it could be a minor moment that ends up being more storytelling. It could be an encounter of fight this thing, or it could be something else entirely. It doesn't always have to be just three newts attack you or whatever. And I really like seeing randomness and encounters and things like this act. I've been trying to get this idea out of my mouth in a way that is eloquent, and I haven't found it yet, so I'm just going to stumble through it. I've often thought of encounters as, like, the sentence, like the full idea, whereas I'm kind of trying to think about them, at least in this matter, as words within the sentence or, like, pieces of a larger thing. So look at encounters rather as being, man, I want to say this right. I have a clear, like, mental image of it, but I cannot get it out of my mouth.
It's like your session's a poem, not a paragraph.
Yeah, I like encounters feeling like lines rather than complete poems. And then by seeing the encounters threaded together, that's where you find the story, rather than just There's an encounter. The story is encapsulated within that encounter. No. Step back. The combination of these smaller encounters forms a larger narrative and story. And that sounds obvious as I'm saying it. But I think if you step back and think of those things as pieces rather than holes that are jumbled together, I think it can do something interesting. Again, I don't have this figured out yet. I know it in my head. I feel it in my bones, okay? But I don't know how to say it.
No, I feel you because with even with those ones that you listed off, those travel encounters, like it's one thing to like see just a bear cub, right? But when you put it in the context of what the party's already doing,
yeah,
like then that's when your like narrative and your game happens, right? And I like to involve the players with that always. So I also like to roll those spend time checks out in the open or have a player roll it. Right?
Oh, for sure.
Like we're gonna roll on the table, and we know. I also like to have like sometimes D6s will have like a skull or a dragon on the one. So like I love to roll those out in the open, like so everyone knows immediately like something's up. First of all, like the specific situation, it might be very obvious to you what the wrinkle's gonna be, right? Like you're gonna climb this tree. It's gonna or it's something huge, right? You've decided that you're not gonna roll for it. You're gonna do spend time, but like. You know, you're going to spend time digging through, you know, digging a hole, right? You, and like the wrinkle's going to be obvious that you're going to, you know, find some critter underneath there, right? Like you don't always have to roll a random wrinkle. It might just happen with what you're doing. And then I like to invite the player to, you know, how did this happen to you? Like you tell me how, you know, how your character ran into a bear or whatever, you know?
It's also amazing, just especially thinking of random tables and stuff, the further you get into the game, like if you look at random tables before you start anything, you're going to think, wow, those are really random. And then when you get to the time when you roll on that table, more often than not, that thing is going to be incredibly profound by its proximity to the story you're telling. It will either fit in the thread that you're already telling, or it will be such an antithesis that it also fits in the thread. Which is always really exciting and rewarding, even if it's always just really exciting and rewarding.
It lets you as the GM be part, have something unexpected happen to you too, right?
Yeah.
It gives you the improv moment. It lets you play the game. You know, you let the module or let whatever kind of table you've set up, let that happen to you a little bit and get excited about it so that you don't always have all the answers. And I think that can just be... That just energizes the table when the GM is also surprised and excited. Like, oh, wait, I rolled this. Okay, here we go, right?
I also, this is a small thing. I totally agree with you about like having the players roll for wrinkles or having them roll for the random encounter, because it's always way more fun to have the players like get mad at each other or get excited with each other. Like, it's just a great like faux antagonistic thing that ends up being really fun at the table of like, ah, damn it, Elliot, you did this, not the dice, not the GM,
and
you did this.
Well, I mean, Perils and Princesses has most of the roles are player roles.
Yeah.
There's a couple instances where you're rolling saves for monsters, but nearly every role is going to be a player role. Just as a matter of design principle for this game.
So we've kind of naturally transitioned into getting into more of the specifics of the game, and I wanna touch on a few of those in particular to help us get ready for the game. And I think that one of the things is that Brian, you talked about in what you were nervous about is like telegraphing to the player's tone and stakes and things like that. So I'm curious, Ryan, how can Brian set the players up the best for success? Like, whether that's starting in character creation of just like what kind of characters should they make for this sort of story?
So by the book, the character generation is largely randomized, like you were saying, and it's going to help you piece together the story of where your character came from and what hidden talents they have and that sort of thing. Now, the main instead of a class like a OSR game would have or a trad game. You have a gift, and your gift comes from your fairy godmother. And so, you know, the different gifts are enchanted voice or a wild heart or healing touch. And I think imagining who your fairy godmother is and like the circumstances around your gift gets you into the headspace of your character pretty quick. So I think like your fairy godmother and your gift, it's almost like everyone's a warlock kind of and has a patron. If you wanted to go that way, like you could. I've had people kind of just, you could do it where your fairy godmother isn't that present. Or I've played plenty of games where people have like hardcore fairy godmommy issues, right? or like baggage or whatever. And that kind of, it puts you in this fairy tale place, it puts you in this fantasy place, and also really grounds you with your magic and why you have it, and how, you know, was your fairy godmother an overbearing theater mom, or were they an eldritch beast that like is completely incomprehensible? Was it a kind old woman that really helps you? Like that kind of built in little bit of backstory can like push you off, and then by, you know, rolling randomly what stuff you have and what's your hidden talent, all of a sudden you have like a built out character idea just by rolling through that.
And I think that, you know, the word princess maybe has a certain image that's conjured to people's minds, but I think that this game, that's a much more flexible term than it seems.
Oh, 100%. I think it's surprising how many people pick up this game. They're like, no, I want to be I have a very specific princess in mind, but the idea is that princess is anyone who has a fairy godmother who's given them a gift, right? So it is, I always say that, you know, Luke Skywalker is a princess because Obi-Wan's his fairy godmother and like speaks to him and gives him like force powers, right?
Star Wars fans, come at us.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, so it's, And you don't have to be like a crown princess, because so many of these stories, you don't find you're not a princess till the end of your story, literally, right? Like you're not crowned the prince of whatever. And even in character creation, like you can have it gives you a list of titles of whatever you wanted to be. So it's kind of a catch all, and it's very evocative of like the kind of story and the kind of inspiration. But I mean, any gender, any kind of backstory, you just had this interaction with a fairy godmother and that made you a princess because you have this kind of humble magic, right?
Let's dive into some nitty-gritty mechanics.
Yeah.
So to start us off, there's a bunch of terms that are like unique to this game that I think we should get into, you know, virtue test, gift dice, heart dice. We've talked about wrinkles and spending time, but to start us off, what is the core dice mechanic of this game? How are we rolling our dice?
That would be the virtue test. You have three stats: resolve, grace, and wits. And any sort of main challenge or check is called a virtue test. And so you have a score for each of those stats, and you roll a d20 and you try to match it or get underneath. So the higher your score, you're better, right? Your higher score is going to increase your odds, but you're going to want to roll low to get your score in under or underneath it.
I'm sorry, we're rolling low in this game. Nat 1 is good.
Nat 1 is a crit, and Nat 20 is a fail. And what that does is it makes it immediately clear if it's a pass or fail. You're not doing, there is a minimal amount of algorithms you're going to have to do. You're not going to have, there's like not, mo- there's no floating modifiers, right? So
right.
You know, by looking at the dice, if it's a pass or fail immediately. And that's why you're rolling low. And it really helps with once you wrap your head around that you're rolling low, it's super smooth, right?
There is going to be a second one I'm going to wrap my brain around it just a little bit, just because it's every other system I've tried, you know, sixes are good, nat 20s are good, roll high. But I do really love the simplicity of a roll under system with like, as you, you know, your stack gets higher, that means you're better at it. That means that it's easier to roll under that number. Very simple. And I also love that there's not that worry of like setting DCs. I don't have to tell you, okay, this is easy, this is hard, this is extra hard with like, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 as the DC. And then you have to like do the math and add in this and can I use this spell to do this? It's very simple. I tell you what stat, you just have to roll the dice and try to get under your stat.
Yeah, so your DCs are going to be, that's impossible, right? That's right. The lowest. The hardest thing is you can't do it. You can do it, but you have disadvantage, right? There's advantage and disadvantage, and that's the thing you're going to be able, that's the little simple switch you're going to be able to do as a GM. So you can't do it. You can do it with disadvantage, straight roll, advantage, right? You have something that's going to, you have a talent, you have the right tool for the job. The circumstances are such that this is a little, you know, you're at a clear advantage. So you roll with advantage, or it just works, right? There's, they've set it up in a way where the risk is all mitigated and you don't, you know, you can't imagine how they would fail. So you just let them succeed, right? That's your DCs. You've got like a little, like five different buttons you can push. It's either nope, disadvantage, straight roll, advantage, or yes, right?
I really love that this again gets back into one of those core tenets of the OSR of heroic, not super heroic. Of like, when you think of, you know, D&D and someone's like, DC 30, you're like, oh, I've got to roll high and then also use all this additional stuff to get there because it's like a godlike task. In this, that's just like, no, you can't, that crazy thing that doesn't make sense in the real world, but the GM has to put a number to it, you just can't do it. You can be creative and find a way to get to that point, but you're not going to get to do it in one swing.
Right. The circumstances as they are, it's impossible. You can change the circumstances.
Yeah, change the circumstances, and I'm excited to see how you change those circumstances. That's the creativity and fun. It's not just... It's again, the other like tenet of like player skill, not character ability. So it's not just like, oh, I have to get to level 8 so I can cast this spell so I can do this thing. It's like, no, you are the player. You have all the same brain power and abilities as the character. Go in, try to change the circumstances of this encounter so that it is now possible or favorable. And I'm very excited for that. That tickles something good in my brain that I'm excited to try.
Yeah, I love that towards the beginning, Ryan, you described it as a problem-solving game at its core, which I think is a great perspective to kind of go into every session and situation with.
This leads really well into another mechanic, another pretty essential mechanic, which is heart dice.
Yeah.
Heart dice, you get, it's a D4, and you get one per level. There's only four levels, so you have one that you can spend. Now you can spend it as you would like a hit dice to heal yourself during a short rest, which we call a picnic. But a better way to spend it is you can always retroactively use it to subtract from a failed roll of one of your other friends or party members, right? So if someone fails a virtue test by like less than four, you can at the very, you know, last minute spend a heart dice to force a success. As long as you can explain how you were able to help them succeed, like it within the narrative, you can spend that dice to help them succeed at the end. After every, and this is a big piece of GM advice, always look at the role and see if they're within a little bit and remind your players, hey, someone can help them. You know, they didn't get it. If you have a heart dice to spend, you can help this role succeed. And that becomes a really, if everyone's in on it and knows and is aware of that rule, it becomes a really important part of playing Perils and Princesses.
That's just such a small addition to a game that is so good, because I feel like every time I've played D&D, hit dice are a thing that are on your character sheet that you basically never use. It's kind of hand waved. You're either taking a long rest or maybe a short rest so some of the spellcasters can regain their spells, and that's kind of it. Having a reason to get excited about this mechanical thing in the game is so great, and I'm really excited to share that with the players and have them like have this like very limited resource to spend and help their friends. Again, it leads into that heroic, not super heroic. Like, those small moments can still be heroic.
Yeah, and it's fun. It's a fun little roleplay prompt too, always, right? Like, okay, I'm going to spend this dice to help you succeed whatever you're doing. Okay, how, like, you can, but you got to explain how you did that, right? Like, what's the thing? And, you know, and I agree with you. It seems like when I first was testing this, it seemed like a cool, small little add-on. But I will say it becomes a big part of the game. I think it's a big part of
I'm sure.
Like, it's a resource everyone's constantly tapping into. It keeps the game moving. It keeps, like, everybody involved in any kind of skill check. It's like a very, I don't know, as long as everyone remembers this rule and, like, the GM is calling out when might be a good opportunity, it becomes a big part of that kind of humble magic and teamwork, you know?
It's great, too, that, like, I think this is true of a lot of OSR games, but especially Perils and Princesses, that every mechanic of the game is useful and exciting. Whereas, like, in D&D, hit dice are borderline vestigial. Like, they're kind of there. There are certain tables that would use them, but largely people aren't excited about hit dice. Heart dice in this game are exciting and cool and fun, and you're like, you want to spend them. Like, that's gonna be a great moment of pretty much any encounter when you get to spend that and get your friend from a near failure to a success.
100%.
So we've talked about tests of virtue and heart dice. There's one other kind of dice in this game that's really fun. Could you tell us about gift dice?
Oh, I'm so excited about gift. I love gift dice so much.
So, giving credit where credit's due, gift dice are inspired by the blog Goblin Punch. Arnold Kemp has a system called the GLOG, the Goblin Laws of Gaming, and wizards use magic dice. And so this is very much inspired by how that mechanic works, even though, you know, all the bits and pieces have been rearranged and streamlined a bit for Perils and Princesses, but that's where the idea came from. How it works is gift dice are D6s. And you use them when you used your special gift abilities. You're using your magic gift that you got from your fairy godmother. And you get one D6 per level that you can spend in order to activate these abilities. Now, the coolest thing about them is rather than operating like a spell slot or like a meta currency where you know exactly, I have two magic points and I can spend two magic points to cast two spells. Gift dice return if you roll a 1, 2, or 3, or they're spent if you roll a 4, 5, or 6. So you have, there's a good chance you'll get it again, and there's a good chance that it'll be gone, and you don't really know that. You don't really know the depths of your magic power at any given point. You have a rough idea of how much magic you can cast in a day. So that's like the fundamental thing of how they operate in terms of a resource. Now, that's kind of a rich roll, because also what you roll is going to affect how much damage your magic does or how big or small of an effect it is too. So the number, typically what happens is if it's a smaller amount of magic, you'll get it back again. And if it's a bigger one, you've spent it all and it'll go away. And to further add another level to this, you get to choose how many you spend on any usage of it. So as you get up in level, you'll have up to 4 gift dice typically. If doubles show up, that's when your wrinkle, that's when your mishap happens.
Mm-hmm.
So you go from rolling one gift dice, there's no chance of mishaps. By the time you're rolling, if you are at 4th level and you're rolling 4 dice, there is a significant chance that there will be a mishap, right? So you've got this rich kind of one roll of dice, I'm going to use my magic, and we're going to find out a lot of things about how this is going to go for everybody, you know?
I love gift dice so much. Because, like, just, I love having a resource that is so fundamental to the game that you do not know when you have depleted it. I love that there's a balance you are trying to strike, because a lot of the abilities, like the number of dice you spend, determines how many, like, creatures it can affect or something like that. And then the sum of the dice determines, like, how big that effect will be. So say it's Fireball, you spend 2 dice, you can affect 2 creatures, you roll a total of 7, they deal 7 damage. I love that there is such a cognitive dissonance in the mind of what a player must be going through when they're rolling those dice, because A, there's a chance I can't do this big thing again, and we might be in the middle of a battle, or at the beginning of the battle, and now I'm, you know, kind of cut off at the knees. I want to roll, you know, say I'm rolling 3 dice, I want to roll all 6s because that's the most damage, but that also means I don't get those dice back. So, like, you're excited when you roll high, but that means you don't get the things anymore. You're excited when you roll low because you get the dice back, but you don't do as much of an effect. At every point, you are excited about what the roll is going to be and are worried about what the roll is going to be. And that fucking rules. That rules so much. It feels more like gambling positive, like gambling fun in a way that I think role-playing games, having like games within games, often really benefit from. Like, having this kind of test your luck mechanic is something that we always really love. Our recent season of Slug Blaster, there was like a mini test your luck game where players were rolling D6s, like trying to get a higher and higher sum without rolling a six. And the amount of stress and joy and like jubilation at every roll that the players experienced was so, so good. And like, A, it's like good audio for, you know, a podcast producer. But as a game master, it's really rewarding to do something where your players are just so into rolling the dice. Like, that becomes so exciting. And so I'm really, really, really looking forward to the first time players start rolling and playing with the gift dice and realizing that they're always going to be rooting both ways for at any dice roll.
It's a killer mechanic. And I think what really, really makes it tick is that it fits thematically with characters that are not experts in their abilities, or their ability is a little bit foreign to them. So what I didn't want was these princesses to know exactly how much of their power they can use at any one point in time. You know, how I wanted to capture that moment of, I'm going to channel deep within myself and use this power, but I might overdo it. It's very, I might do too much. I might, something could go wrong. I don't know if I can save any. I might let it all out at once, you know? And then when I, you know, stumbled upon this system where you just don't know if you're going to get it back, if you don't know, where there's so many variables, but that was also so easy to see.
Yeah.
It just seemed like the perfect fit for these characters.
That is the, like, the low key highlight of this system as well. It's so easy. It's so, like, it's, or not so easy, it's so simple that, like, you immediately roll and you immediately understand the consequences, which, as someone who sometimes doesn't like dice pool systems because you kind of have to sit back and, like, decipher the dice pool, I really like this. I really like this, and I'm excited to do it.
Hi, I'm Maia, and this is Maia's Game Room, a narrative actual play anthology featuring short-form, story-driven TTRPGs. Each season tells a new story using a different rules-light system brought to life with sound design, editing, and emotional-rich roleplay. So, if you love cinematic storytelling and character-driven drama, come check out Season 1, set in the haunting world of the Electric State RPG. Just search Maia's Game Room wherever you get your podcasts.
It was a key tenet, like a key guide rail for designing Perils and Princesses, that there would be, you would know immediately what the dice meant when they were rolled.
Yeah.
And that it was going to be dicey and not mathy. You're going to use all your, you're going to buy your cool dice and you're going to be able to use all of them or a lot of them. But we're not going to be doing too much, like, you know, no algorithms, right? We don't have floating modifiers. We're not trying to hit a DC and get boosts that way.
Man, dicey, not mathy is a great line.
And how, Ryan, do these mechanics translate then into specifically combat?
So should you get to combat, right? The first thing that happens is an initiative roll. And I have been on the record that I like any initiative that isn't just roll and then go in order of the roll. So initiative is everyone tests wits. It still fits in with a core mechanic. You do a wits test. If you succeed, you go before the baddies. And if you fail, you go after the baddies. In any order you choose, right? So what ends up happening is you get these teamwork moments. You've split the party into kind of two squads that can kind of work out what order they're going to go in, if they're like the first ones or after. And from there, you're going to test resolve for an up-close attack, grace for a ranged attack, and then you're also going to test grace to defend yourself when the baddies are attacking. So you're doing most of the rolling on your side. There are two hit rolls. There's a lot of OSR systems that forego them, right? So if you're playing Cairn or in other Into the Oddish games, they're doing direct damage, which is more deadly and moves faster and is a great playstyle, and I like it. But that's not how Perils and Princesses works. It's more like the black hack with half the stats. Yeah, so three stats instead of a full D&D six stats. So we're rolling to hit, and then we're rolling damage. And then armor is a soak where your armor is just reducing the damage. The enemy stat blocks are pretty simple. Enemies have hit points, or heart points, I should say. They have heart points, they have an armor value, they have a damage, and they usually have some kind of, either they can cast spells or they've got something that happens if you get wounded by them. Usually it inflicts some kind of curse. Certain things might ignore their armor, but there's usually just a couple sentences to help you run any kind of adversary.
I've never gotten to play a game where you are rolling to defend rather than the GM is rolling to hit. And I imagine, I'm excited to feel that in play, because I think it's going to feel really exciting for the players, because rather than it being taken out of my hands and my character gets hit by something that I can't defend against, it is, oh, I dodged, I parried, yeah, or oh, I missed. Like, it puts it back in the player's hands and in their control, and it feels more like they have the ability to narrate how that happens. I mean, you always do, but that feels like you, like the control is gifted to the player first rather than to the GM in a way that I really like.
Yeah, and it keeps the integrity of the core mechanic too, right? Like, yeah, you're not doing something different. You're still using the core mechanic. So a lot of times you'll have the situation, just like you said, where, okay, the troll has his club. He's coming down at you. Test grace to quickly avoid it. Okay, shoot, I missed. Oh, I only missed by one. Does anyone have a heart dice to help me? Oh, I've got a heart dice to help you. I spend it. At the last second, I threw a rock at the troll, and he looked over and missed. You know, so like the
yeah,
it dynamic. Just push. Yeah, it just keeps pushing it. And then it's like, okay, now it's, you know, now the troll went, what is this, you know, then it just keeps going. And I will say, like, once you get into a combat situation, there's also, because the core mechanic carries over, there is about half a page on something called antics. What it is just empowers you not to just roll to hit in the combat. So because you can do it, you're still in the game, you still can do anything, right? So your goal isn't always to reduce hit points. And even if you try to roll to hit and aren't using heart dice, you could get into sloggy territory pretty quick. So the key to combat is always going to be using your heart dice and using your gift dice to accomplish your goal. And I think that's always an important thing to encourage people to, or encourage players, is think about your surroundings. You think about what you can work. You can always work together. Your turn isn't siloed, right? Because you've rolled initiative and you have two people acting now. What kind of wacky antics and crazy schemes can you come up with is going to be way more interesting, you know, than we're going to roll the hit and see what happens to these goblins or whatever.
There's also not like mechanics that are granting advantage or disadvantage, or at least not a lot of mechanics that are doing that. It's like, it's pure creativity of, what if I add this little bit of antics to this? Now, oh, okay, now I'll give you advantage. Like, it really rewarding that creativity rather than just, let me daisy chain these abilities in the right order.
Yeah, yeah. I think the mechanical side is going to come from the game world. And that's why it's so important to be very, you know, very free with information about what's around them and what's at stake.
Mm.
I am also a fan of the hard no every now and then for comedic purposes of like, hey, what if, can I add honey to my sword for advantage? No! Like, just the hard no sometimes is very fun to like reestablish the world.
Unless they're fighting bees.
Unless they're fighting bees, or if they're fighting a band.
That's a hard yes.
And I'm like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
I mean, the cleverness should get everyone excited, right? It shouldn't feel like you're getting pulled a fast one. You should be like, oh, that's actually an amazing, right? Like, oh, shoot, that's cool and smart and makes for a good moment. Like, yeah, then let's do it. It shouldn't just be like, yeah, okay, I guess. And then you kind of undermine your game world a little bit.
I feel like, despite the fact that this game is so swingy, like in typical OSR fashion, it's not deadly. Like, it's not easy to die in this game. It seems that you've laid out a system where that is a very narrative choice, and it's not you're not going to accidentally lose your character. Could you talk about wounds and trauma and how, what like character death would look like, even if you decided to go there?
Yeah, yeah. So if you lose all your heart points in battle, you are incapacitated and you roll on the wound table. It's a D8 table and there's 8 different outcomes, right? And typically there are different injuries, kind of categories of mechanical things that you're going to have that might linger. So you're going to be out for the battle. And if everyone gets wounded in battle, then you're, you know, then it's up to the GM to see what happens, right? Or were you captured, or you found, you know, what narratively happened to your incapacitated, wounded party, right? Rolling an 8 on a D8 gives you a trauma. You also get trauma if you take enough HP heart points worth of damage. That's like double. If you take like an enormous amount at once, or an amount that's bigger than your max, then you also get a trauma. And a trauma gives you, it's kind of like 3 strikes and you're out. It can give you like sort of fear of whatever caused your trauma as you get 1 or 2. But as at the third one, it's time for this character's adventure to end. And what that means is up to you. So it's up to you and your table and your GM. Does it mean that they died? Does it mean that they retired, that they called it quits because this was too many close calls? Does it mean that they were lost forever, right? And are now an NPC that the next party is going to need to find, right? So it's more of a, it's your story is ended, but it's up to the world you've created what happens. It's not like, if you want your character to die when they end, that could be cool, but it's up to you how this story ends, right?
I love that as a choice. Like, it's like it everybody knows that, who's played like classic D&D or even like 5e, that having your character just die because of bad luck rolls in a combat sucks. So making it like there is a lot of mechanical crunch to getting to the end of your character story, but even then it's not just, and now they're dead. Sorry.
Yeah. It rounds the corners of that sharp edge, yeah, but still doesn't fully blunt the sword, which I really like.
Yeah. Yeah, I always think consequences are like interesting consequences are more interested than just a death. So
yeah.
A lot of wounds come with like ways to mechanically deal with them. You've got ailments which are woozy and weary and befuddled, which are just getting disadvantage on a stat. You've got a number of curses, so if you get wounded by it in a certain way, you'll get a curse inflicted, and curses usually have a strange way of alleviating it, and some kind of either mechanical or in-game disadvantage. And that kind of stuff is just, it's just so much more exciting than, okay, you're done, right? Like, you've got a new toy to play with now, right? You've got a new weird thing going on. And again, it goes back to that before, like no matter what the dice show, it's going to be exciting, right?
So as we start to round out this conversation before we get out of here and get to the season proper,
yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Sweet Revenge, which is the thing that kind of was the final list on the selling items for Brian. So Ryan, could you tell us a bit about Sweet Revenge and if you have any specific advice for kind of running in this system?
And we're keeping this one very spoiler-free.
Very spoiler-free.
Okay, a little backstory here on Sweet Revenge. Shortly after Perils and Princesses came out, I got an email from Destiny Howell, who was like, I had never talked to her before. And she was like, hey, I noticed that in the Perils and Princesses license, there's provision for making unofficial content. Have you ever thought about official content? And I was like, yeah, I've thought about official content. Like, what do you got? And she showed me some stuff she was planning on, and then she pitched me on Sweet Revenge, and I was like, no, we like full steam ahead. This is the next one, because I felt that Perils and Princesses, as something that's designed to be inviting for new players, it needed a full campaign. It needed the tool. It needed another tool to complete its potential. And what she laid out for Sweet Revenge was fantastic. So the basics of it is a cursed forest adventure. You have a witch that was defeated, right? We're coming in after another quest. This witch was defeated, but with her dying words has cursed this land, and now everyone is turning into candy.
And now you can see why I was so excited about this.
Yeah.
So the animals are turning into candy. The people in the village are becoming different confections. And this group of princesses who's coming in to check this out is now tasked as the folks who are not cursed yet.
Yet being an operative word.
Yeah, with getting to the bottom of this. You've got this sort of infectious candy curse about. So that's where you get to those, hey, if you get wounded by this certain candy thing, now you're becoming candy, right? Yeah, and I don't want to go too spoilery, but there's like a number, it's kind of a smallish hex crawl with a couple adventure locations, tons of fantastic NPCs with all these interconnected relationships. There's loads of side quests. It's a very complete little world. And yeah, you can get through a full arc of Perils and Princesses right there.
I'm so goddamn excited about it.
I love a tonal conflict in anything. Like Candy Curse is just like, I love when you take something cute and nice and mash it up with something evil. That's always a delight.
It is very fun to have that. You can, again, this is like a reason why I love fairy tales. You can go anywhere on the spectrum and it can be interesting. Like there can be moments where that Candy Curse is like a little bit goofy, like, ooh, there's a squirrel with Skittle eyes or whatever. And then you can get all the way to horrifying of that NPC that you care deeply about is now just a gummy bear.
Right.
And like that.
And they're being eaten.
A bird on top of them taking pieces of them and you've got to get the bird off. There's just so much room to play in that. It's so evocative. It immediately feels very like exciting fairy tale without me having to do, like, I haven't done anything. All I have to tell players is there's a candy curse and like, oh, we're in it. We all kind of know what the vibe is going to be. And then we can play with that tone and that vibe throughout the campaign.
Ryan, before we get out of here, something that we always like to ask the designers of the games we play is there something from Perils and Princesses that you haven't maybe seen used in the game at all or often that you would really love to see Brian and the players like play around with and take advantage in this season?
Yeah, we talked about gift dice and I would love to see more people use multiple gift dice and I want to see what happens when mishaps happen. I think it's a rare occurrence because I think people are very careful of a mishap, but they're always like, I think they're cool. I think they're fun. I think the tables are interesting. So I like when people overclock their gift abilities. Whenever I'm playing in real life, I'm always like, yeah, let's see if it happens. So remembering that doubles means mishap is always hard too, because there's so many other things that happen with a gift roll. So that's one not to forget, is to always look out for doubles.
All right, so we're gonna be doing a lot more mishaps. We're gonna encourage the players to throw out their gift dice liberally and freely, yes, and be doing a lot of magic and using the talents. Actually, I have one more cute question for you, Ryan. Do you have a favorite little bit of like magic or something in a talent that like you wrote in this game that's just like your favorite little bit of like you particularly love it?
Oh man, That's a good question, because I've got a lot of little references are hidden. You know, there's Easter eggs and references to different fairy tales throughout the whole thing. I think one of the ones that was like one of the first abilities I knew was going to be in this game as a princess ability is the Give a Little Whistle ability, which is the name of it is a reference to Pinocchio, but the ability is a reference to, you know, just Disney in general, specifically like the movie Enchanted with Amy Adams, where she sings a song and then all like the New York roaches and pigeons come to help her. So yeah, that's an ability. You just summon any nearby creatures that will help you with one thing. And whatever you roll is going to be determined. You know, if you roll two dice, you could get two big creatures, or the sum of the dice can be little creatures. And I leave it open whether the GM decides what they are, or if someone's trying to call something specific. I usually let them, you know, I want to call a bunch of moles to help me dig under this door is usually pretty fun. But yeah, it's just one of the best Perils and Princess abilities that gets used a lot, because it's a level one ability and it's a really evocative and inspires so much creativity, right?
It feels like the tone of the game in an ability of just like doing the classic cute princess moment, but for the sake of adventuring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So Brian, coming back to you, how are you feeling after this conversation? Are you feeling ready to run Perils and Princesses?
I'm feeling ready. I'm feeling good. I'm really excited for this. I think
I think a lot of the tone of this like kind of falls right in my wheelhouse, which I think is why I was really excited about it. I'm really excited about the mechanics because of the like speed at which you can do them and like the amount that they get out of your way. That, you know, dicey, not mathy is a line I'm going to use forever. Like, that actually perfectly describes what I like about role-playing games. I want to roll dice. That is very fun. I don't want to be delayed in my fun by doing the math. And I know, like, in recent seasons, there may have been times when I'm like, I kind of just want people to, like, roll the dice, go, let me, the crazy stuff's happening, go. And sometimes you're impeded by this. I know that's not going to happen in this game, and I'm really excited about it. I think my biggest worry is still just like communicating the tone to the players and like deciding the tone together and making sure that everyone properly adjusts their headspace from the games that they are used to playing to this game so that we can all really get on board and really have the most fun possible in the type of system that this is. And I don't anticipate that's going to be a problem. It's just like it's the first hurdle on the that is in front of me, so it's the one I'm most worried about. But once you clear that, then, you know, the hurdles just get easier and easier and easier. So overall, I'm very excited. If you can't tell from the tone of my voice, I'm very excited about this game. This is going to be rad.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on and helping us get set up for the season. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online and where they might grab Perils and Princesses and Sweet Revenge?
Yeah, I am Outrider Creative on Itch and Instagram and Blue Sky and TikTok. And if you want to grab Perils and Princesses and Sweet Revenge, the best place online is through Tabletop Bookshelf.
Hell yeah. We love Tabletop Bookshelf.
We love Tabletop Bookshelf. Oh, okay. I love when we do an in sync moment. It's so funny.
And that is all for this episode of My First Dungeon, Perils and Princesses. Join us next week for our Session Zero, where we are going to meet a group of princesses ready to face a whole new world. Special thanks to our sponsor for this season, Tabletop Bookshelf. Tabletop Bookshelf is one of the best places to buy indie games online, and we are thrilled to be partnering with them for this season. If you want to grab your own copy of Perils and Princesses or the adventure module where we're going to be playing Sweet Revenge, just head on over to tabletopbookshelf.com and use the promo code PERIL15. That's PERIL15 to get 15% off your order. But do not delay because this offer is only extended to the first 100 orders. So if you want to get that discount, head on over to tabletopbookshelf.com right this instant. And remember, if you're having fun, you're already doing it right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.